What if all this was just a game and life wants to play with us? For me, I don't quite realize how it's a question because this is how I see things. So what if life is just a game, was just a game, and life wants to play with us? So it's, we could say, if life is just a game and life wants to play with us, what does that perspective bring that's helpful? And what's limiting about it? When would that perspective not be helpful? I think there's a couple of ways that it can be deeply helpful kind of way of taking life. That can, when we so often, we all say so many times, not maybe every single person, but many of us so often will feel that we're at the edge of a cliff and we just want to jump. And then it's like, how can I get myself to jump? And the feeling is that we're not quite strong enough or brave enough or serious enough or desperate enough. And if we would have that sense that we're at the edge of a cliff and it could be like playfully being at the edge of the cliff, it wouldn't just be about a way to trick ourselves into jumping, but it could be a way to trick ourselves out of that pressure that I'm on the edge of a cliff and I have to jump. Because if I'm playful at the edge of a cliff, I might find that the cliff is just as enlightening as the lack of cliff, the air, for example. And what I've seen actually happen, by the way, now that we're at the edge of the cliff, more often is just by being tired, we fall off the cliff. So there's a kind of way that playfulness can help us break up these huge icebergs that we have in our mind, different ways that we perceive reality that leave out so much of what's really going on in our own experience and so much of what could be in our experience if we weren't leaving it out. And so there's that kind of level where just breaking up the concepts is important, and playfulness can help us do that, can help us. So we've been playing with feeling the small intestine, for example, a couple of days ago, which is a weird thing to do, and something, well, it's weird enough that probably we'd never done it before unless we were sick, had a lot of gas or something, or nothing coming out or whatever. Maybe because of a problem, we put attention there, but for no reason, just to feel our guts. Has anyone done it before? I had never done it before. You've done it before. So playfully to break up our okay. Our chunks of thought into bite-sized bits. And then maybe the second way that playfulness more deeply can change the way we experience, what we experience, maybe is in the second half of the question, what if life wants to play with us? So the way we talk about like playing a game, and it can be taken in two ways. So much of our time we spend playing games in the sense of trying to negotiate and get what we want by pushing the right buttons. So the standard example would be like playing the game of being the good yogi or the bad yogi, the obedient one, the disobedient one. Either way, we're likely to get more attention, which is what we're actually secretly trying to get. Secretly, often to ourselves as well. When we stop playing those games, life plays with us. And life plays with us also we could say in two ways, or in what feels like two ways. Life plays with us in the sense that we can experience what used to seem so real as being dreamlike. And so our previous assumptions are not continually localizing our experience back in the same old places, so there are more possibilities. And it's more like joy that swings through us. So we can be full of surprises every day. And then there's the way that life plays with us when the surprises are not so pleasant. So in some spiritual circles, we talk about grace. And when something that seems wonderful happens, we say, oh, it was the guru's grace or God's grace or whoever's grace. The grace of the chocolate box. And of course, when things are unpleasant, we think we've fallen out of grace. So that's the kind of little bit more subtle level where we're basically still playing games, trying to get grace by pushing the right buttons. And when we don't get what we wanted, we must have pushed the wrong buttons. Instead of what we want, what we didn't want is what we really needed, maybe. Or it's not even that negotiable of a game. It's not even that because it came, because I didn't want it and it came, I must have needed it. It's not only that sort of simplistic either. Sometimes taking it that way can help, but it's not, I don't think, only that simplistic. But playing with life, letting life play with us. Anything that comes in our experience can immeasurably enrich the game. The danger of that perspective, life is a game, would be so easy to keep just skirting around, like going all around the parts that we don't want to see, we don't want to experience, because we want to play. We don't want to be serious. So here's the third question. Also, because we might not get through the questions, and it's maybe more important if you have something to say in the now, so do feel free to pop. Is there any popcorn yet? Do you think it is important to remember or write down spiritual heights reached or experiences that occurred during retreats? And I love in this note, it's signed, thanks, comma, Jaya. Mm-hmm. Meaning thanks to me, but as if I wrote to myself. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jaya. What do you think? My camera broke in February, and I've been without a camera except when I could borrow Evan's and Jess's for a couple of days. And there are grandparents to be fed with photos of a grandchild. And one time I was walking, probably to call Jan's grandmother, now that I think about it, in the morning. And in that kind of flame tree that was with no leaves and just the red flowers, there were two of the gray, black-faced langur monkeys in the tree eating the flowers. It was too beautiful to make a good photograph. So I'm really glad that I didn't have my camera, because I would have probably gone running back for the camera to take the picture. But it was too evocative is the word that comes. It said too much to go into a photo, like it could have been more of a painting maybe. But because I couldn't record it, it's recorded, like it's really with me. And that doesn't mean I wouldn't like to have a camera. So, in the mind, when we would like to have a guideline, what we should do and what we shouldn't do. If we could kind of feel into a little bit closer to home, where maybe what I'm asking for is to be pushed a little bit, like what I usually do maybe is write it down. And maybe somewhere I'm asking my friend Jaya to tell me that I don't have to always write it down and give me a little bit of juicy tip about why not. Not to say like you should not, and not that you should. But if I would answer that question just yes or no, or maybe, or sometimes, I think we would miss the underlying friendship that's there. What I've noticed about my friends is that asking for the like almost unbearable, asking for the almost unbearable. And so if we would just say like yes, no, maybe sometimes when you feel like it. Even if we would say the truth, follow your heart, and we would just talk about it up there and not admit that there's a powerful friendship going on. We might not go past like the breaking up of the iceberg into. So Ajay often quotes the Indian spiritual tradition talking about the different ways of knowing, where there's just curiosity that I don't really even want an answer. Like, what was the name of that sweet? And then, well, I'm not going to remember anyway. Who cares? Don't like it, or whatever. Or, can we pass it around again? And actually give me the address of the shop, and not just the name of the sweet. So the curiosity that maybe is just more like bouncing along, keeping a conversation going, than really about the information. And then there's knowing about. And as we know more finely, in a more refined, deep way, about life, about our experience, these kind of sheets of assumptions and expectations and associations are not so solidly laid across our experience. So there's a question somewhere about, which it might be one, there's a couple that I'm not sure if they're jokes or not. That we could use as an example. So the second kind of knowing is knowing about, and the third kind of knowing is knowing as. So feeling that in friendship, we actually wish to be asked to move into what is nearly unbearable. That demanding love. Which does shake us a lot more than just experiencing in isolation. So maybe I try to add this question in. Jayaji, during the guided meditation, you said that there are millions of creatures in our bodies, even more than there are cells. I remember that last year you said that there is also a huge amount of creatures in the soil, the earth, the ground, the dirt. Are they the same? Anyway, I would like to know more about them and possibly happily shake hands with them. which it might, I don't know if it's a joke or like a really sweet sweetness.
Samantha, sweet as this.
So there might be in some people a passing interest in the fact that there are more other creatures inside our body than we have cells in our body, and that there are so many creatures in the soil that we would not be able to live if they weren't living. That could be a cool kind of trick to learn, like, oh yeah, like a party, what do they call those? Like a party line or a party trick. We can call it a party trick. Which could come in handy if one is feeling insecure and you can't quite get out of the insecurity and you just have to say something. Or maybe someone's bothering you, like, where are you coming from, madam, and how much money do you make? Did you realize? When it comes playfully, it's, even if it's a trick, we're not actually playing a game in a tricky way. We're letting life play with us. If it would be like, I'm arming myself with information, then we're blocking our life. Okay, so then knowing about millions of creatures that we literally can't live without. And what's also interesting is that I find, like, it's easy to think that the scientists, even if I don't know about them, the scientists must know about them. But they don't. They don't. They don't know, there's not even names for a lot of these underground creatures. We just know enough to know that there's a lot of unknown that we depend on for our life. And that in itself is interesting enough to start to break up the possibility of living in the knowing about world. So the knowing about and the curiosity about world can go along, especially when we think, well, the scientists know. And if I would ever need to know, I could just go and ask them. But when we know that they don't know, and they don't know because they don't care enough to know, because if they did care enough to know, they would go underground and start measuring and finding ways to describe. The fact that they haven't bothered to describe can help us find, like, the hole, the gap in that kind of knowing, the knowing about. The knowing about is like, we can describe, but we can't explain. And so then there is the possibility even now that we could move towards not relying on those who know to know, so that I don't even need to bother to be curious, much less want to know about in my own experience, to know about. But this confidence that could just like flare up like a fire to actually know as, to be willing to commune with invisible life support system. That this is our possibility, that we can actually know. And from the experience, another kind of, I could say for today, we could explain, kind of, and not just describe. on one retreat, John Seed, who's a deep ecologist, who's like an eco-warrior from Australia, taught with us. And he led a couple of guided meditations. One was really almost like a guided performance art, where he laid out a long piece of string in a spiral that was really measured, like by steps. And along the way were candles. So it was a long, 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 long way around before we got to the first candle, which was, I don't know exactly, I don't remember the details, but like maybe the Big Bang or something like that. Or maybe starting with the Big Bang until anything that we've recorded as important came along was like probably more than half the time or something like this. And then again, a really long time before planet Earth, and then a really, really long time before the first cell. And then getting faster and faster and faster towards us. And so this was included in the retreat to kind of bust up our ideas of how important we are. How we just came like so soon after the flowers, the dinosaurs and the flowers. And the first community, I remember the way he said, community! There were a few cells together. He was playing the guitar. He must have done that guided thing like thousands of times around the planet. Smiling. Helping Ulrika know when to light the candle. But what I have from that experience together is not just realizing how wide of a community we're a part of, or how nearly insignificant we are, etc. Or how much has gone in to bring us here, also the appreciation of all of that. But like an experience of space that happened that evening. If it's really love, then why does it hurt so much? Yes. This is where we are somewhere deeply asking our friends to ask us to do the nearly impossible. Because we don't do it alone. And it's what we're here for. I remember in the years that I was with Punjaji, Papaji, in Lucknow. I had never heard about this love hurts, like the real love hurts thing. And so I wrote this letter asking, like, what's going on? I feel like I've just been run over by the truck of love. And I remember when most people were not writing this kind of letter to him. They were talking about either bliss or their relationships. And so it's maybe important to know that all the ways that we think it is going to hurt or should hurt, it doesn't. And all the ways that we think it's going to be easy and no effort, it's going to hurt. But not in the way that we would imagine. Because when we think of pain, I think we already brace ourselves and go into defense. And think about time and how long we still have left and progress and who's doing better and worse. And it's so not like that. It's in our in our unique likenesses of love. Like in the Judeo-Christian tradition, they talk about being made in the image of God. So I would say we are the unique likenesses of love, each of us unique likenesses of love. There's not any role model that we can go with. And so the ways we would like to be kind of lazy. Okay, when my father started his job 41 years ago, the deal was that you worked way too much for maybe like about 5 years, 6 years. Way too much. You would jeopardize the health of yourself and your family, probably ruin your marriage. And then you would slowly start to be able to work less and less and less until the end, when you got to make the most money for the least effort. That was the deal that he entered his career in. And somewhere in the middle of his career, they changed the rules, for better or worse. For him, not so nice, but they changed the rules. And the way they changed the rules also is not such a brilliant idea. What it means is you just keep working way too much the whole time. And you're constantly measured, no matter how much you are upholding your company or whatever in so many unmeasurable, immeasurable ways, you're still given money according to a certain kind of hours that you work, not even all the hours that you work. He's a lawyer. This is his last year, supposedly. Turned 70 last month. So, as likenesses of love, we are in the company of other likenesses of love. And I do think that somewhere there's a kind of sense that, okay, there might be a deep respect for those who have gone before, so to speak, from whom we can learn. And we don't know how to navigate that because we love and hate those people somewhere above that deep respect. They show us what we're not, which we love and we hate to know. They show us an expression of unique likeness of love in flowered power. And we know we have that in us, and we know that that hasn't been empowered completely. And so it would be much easier, it would be easier to think that if I just put in enough of way too many hours, if I put in enough of something measurable, they'll have to give it to me. They will have to give it to me. They'll have to pay me more. And maybe more will be enough. And if we go that way, then the rules, of course, do change halfway. And we have to keep doing more. And where our invitation lies in this life is in letting go of what is burdensome, like what is weighing us down, like knowing I cannot carry this. But by putting it down, it doesn't mean I'm erased. It doesn't mean I'm giving up. So the question of laziness, like here on deep rest retreat, with so little schedule coming from them, from outside. what we think of as lazy, and it could keep coming up. I remember so many people talking about remembering when they were little and just lying in bed sweetly for a little while, and then someone coming in and saying, "What are you doing in bed? Make up, get out of bed and make up your bed and make up your sister's bed too." And these memories come back and kind of jolt us, like the whole nervous system goes back on alert. And so then to again find a way that the nervous system could go back into the background and something else can come to the foreground. Where we're not being so careful in that way, trying to get it right, for example. But still not letting go of this like utmost caring to try to see and stay with the authenticity, like the authentic way, the authentic likeness that's here. It would be so much easier, and sometimes maybe we need to rest for a while in that way, in that lazy way of just doing it the way someone else does it. And then eventually that's going to bump up against our life and against our the truth of us. And it's going to demand in a way that out of love we can't resist. That we just wait, knowing we do not know. There are so many things we do not know. But that this authenticity is only here, available. Authentic language, authentic symbolism, as there's communication with deeper levels of us and of our life that goes beyond us. Authentic use of the mind, authentic relation. Okay, this is another one that it's probably a joke, but I'm not sure. How will we pay for this? How will we pay for this? So one answer is not the way we think, which, speaking of my father, whatever we may pay, trying to pay to get it, it's not going into our bank account. Whatever way we try to be like that one, that other one. It can help for a while, but only to that point that then we see all that we need to, all these things that we must let go of that are not. Not true for us. So the way of taking in what comes in our experience as teaching, the way of taking it in authentically, and the way of letting life express authentically. How will we pay for this? Sometimes it can feel like being together, being allowed and encouraged to really do what your heart owns, kind of thing. Having time not to know and to be surprised. And for people at least to be trying to be in touch with this intention to be love. With an honesty about how mostly what we really want is love. Whatever game is placed on top of that, trying to get the love, but we're here trying to feel that and trying to be love. So in a way, we're in a kind of paradise. And there's a way of being here that we can feel like, how am I going to pay for this? It's going to be hard to leave paradise, to be kicked out of paradise. So again, it's partly to say, that what we're getting here and really making our own, we cannot pay for. And the question doesn't enter anyone's mind how this could be paid for. It cannot be. And in a way, that's an important point. So again, I just, maybe it clears things again, like, if I think I can pay for something to get it, then I'm playing that kind of game that's not life playing with me, playing through me. And I'm going to lose eventually. When I feel that precious sense of this cannot be paid for, what is most precious and what we could feel most thankful for in our life? If we cannot go too quickly, like it's a huge paradox to break us open or stretch us open or help us be as wide as we are, where it is the most precious. And I don't mean anything like, I'm not saying like what we're giving you, or I'm just saying in life when there we feel this is precious. That sense that of precious, this is precious, that's life. So there's a question somewhere like, what is reality? So that's the beginning of the answer to that. That's not what we need to buy or pay for or earn. That's life. That's what we are, what we have. And it is impossible to pay for. In the sense of like, the gratitude is without any limit. And that is important to have with us at all times. That's one way of feeling how it is possible, no matter what happens. To live as a likeness of love. Then there's somehow like the other edge that we can be stretched to. What is our calling? What is our call? So this, like, why does love hurt? And what is it that in us that's edging towards the friends that ask of us the nearly impossible? Who let us hate and love them? Because it's not about them. But it's not as a payment. It's as adding to the precious, more immeasurably precious. How can I have the courage to let that which is immeasurably precious be seen? And even if it would be seen and thrown away, absolutely without any, without, with no demand. And this is where our practice gets fiery, with not wishing to add the lightest feather of demand to be seen or appreciated or even understood. Yeah. Kind of way that there, this has to be seen, not because I should and must and so on, but because it would hurt much more to crush it down, to be afraid of it. This is where, like, the our so-called giving and so-called receiving deepen each other. So if the person who wrote this question had something to say with the question, if you want to say anything, how will we pay for this? If there was something specific. And this one, was it, not sure it was meant to go in the box or not? Yes? No, if it was, I'm just checking. Okay. It's kind of following from an interview, so it's mostly for the time. I would have to explain that Dharma talk and then that interview and then that interview. maybe it will come somehow other way. Okay. Can you talk more about the meaning of the big toe? The victory toe, you mentioned in the guided meditation. What about the meaning of the thumb and the other fingers or toes? So, what I thought was if some people would like to volunteer to hold their big toes for a few minutes while we go on to the next question. Okay. Whatever you want, 1, 2, none. Through the sock is also fine. Okay, don't forget that. Okay. What is reality? Reality is love for me. That's the word that you know I use. And when we find ways not to be so easily hooked into our isolation, and we find the ways that we like and love to be hooked by something, like by deepness, so find the ways that life can kind of shake us, pull us, caress us, do the unexpected to us, That's one of the meanings of the good too. Some stomach gurgling going on. Thank you for demonstrating. So then we start to lose track of our filters. Of how we expect things to be. And then, this of course is one of those questions that we could do a month-long retreat called What is Reality? What is real? But what comes just now? Is as we allow that to embrace us, kind of catch us when we fall and when we jump, when we dissolve and when we're solid, there's something familiar and shocking at the same time, I find. Any big toe reports yet? Did you feel anything like that?
Mm-hmm.
Or just hear it?
I heard it, yeah. I heard it. It was a much louder gurgle than
usual. Yeah. The base of the big toe, number 7, is called Victory in Jinshin Jutsu, in case you were not in the guided meditation on Tuesday. Yesterday? Yesterday? And it's a place that we come to when we've fully exhaled and given away the breath and haven't received anything in return yet. So it's kind of apt for the discussion today. Why is that called victory and success? So, any reports yet, or should we do another question in between? Do you feel? So maybe some relaxation in the pelvis area, some unusually loud gurgling in the stomach. Anyone else?
And some warmth around the sort of diaphragm.
Mm-hmm. Warmth around the diaphragm. Warmth around the diaphragm. Anyone else?
The other big toe gets tickling.
Uh-huh. Yep. Anything else tickling?
I feel sick in the stomach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone said yes?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Back.
Nauseated. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay. So these are some of the signs of what happens when energy moves. And I think it's an important kind of expression of how dangerous it could be to say what this is, what number 7 is. This is what the base of the big toe is. Because then my diaphragm is tingling, I have loud gurgles, I feel nauseated, I feel release. We would think we're supposed, if I don't feel nauseated, I'll think I should feel nauseated. If I feel cold instead of heat next time, well, what's wrong? Maybe I should do the other toe, or maybe a finger, or... So I don't know if you could feel, we can keep it this brief, just the kind of aliveness of that, like people's actual experience. And then it's helpful having a few people together to kind of hear what's similar, what's different, so that we feel more freedom to go with what I actually experience. And for example, maybe I feel nauseated and it's better to take my hand off the toe, or maybe I can accept this as a sign of energy moving, and maybe it starts to get better and something, some important shift can take place. So feeling nausea might not always be a bad sign, or it might be enough energy moving already. Let's not let's not stir the soup. So I like the question in the sense that it can help to hear just enough to go on. So like, let's say in learning a foreign language, if we have a few words of Hindi that we start to use, then we get a few more. A few more can come and we know them in a different way. And then maybe we study a little bit more and then we can play with it a little more. And gradually we can flow with Hindi and with energy. So with the other fingers, I really hesitate to say the really simple version of what can happen by holding the finger. And I could just give one example. A friend you may have seen has come to visit for a few days. He's one of the first people I met when I went to Lucknow in 1991 to meet Papaji. So long time friendship. And he practices craniosacral balancing, and he knows that I do Jinshin. We often exchange treatments. And one time I told him, if you're going on a long flight, he said, what can I do? And just hold each finger one by one, maybe 5 minutes each finger, both hands, to reduce jet lag. That's all I said, currently. But he did it. That's the important thing. And then he found himself doing it not just on long flights, and he finds it very, very helpful. And I am sure, in his case, if I would tell him that this means that in a simplistic way, he would probably stop holding his fingers, which is helping him, because, oh, does this mean that I have such and such a negative emotion now, or what's wrong with my liver, or whatever. So I'm going to brace myself and not tell you the simple way of remembering something about the fingers. And just remind you about this experience of, like, you can hold your fingers and tell me what you experience. We can talk about it. And it's not to say, like, I don't want you to know this secret teaching that's so powerful, or you don't deserve it yet, or something. It's so that that knowing about way of being moved doesn't interrupt the knowing as. So we can experience and learn something about by our own experience, but also there's some kind of encounter with the thumb that's more possible when I don't think I know what I'm doing to myself by holding my thumb. What's going on in the bladder?
Yeah, I felt something very...
Ah, just now with the toe?
No, when we did the...
When we did the meditation. Could you say what you experienced?
I asked it what it wanted, and it seemed to want to be relaxed. And then I relaxed, and then it seemed like fireworks. And then I was like, oh God, it's too much. Put the lid back on.
Have you gone back there?
No, I haven't gone
back. Okay, go back there. Okay, good. Did you have a sense of what the fireworks were kind of about, so to speak?
It was a kind of wildness. So, yeah. That was the thing.
Anyone else with a bladder feeling? By chance? Is the goal, if there is one, to remain in a state of love for all people, all things, all the time? I think we've kind of covered that one. And maybe, again, we could say, probably if I make it my goal, if I make it my goal, then it's not the goal. And if I feel how it is, what is, then I can let that take over. And in that taking over, there will be experiences of love that don't match my previous experience, my so far experience of the state of love. Because love has a wildness. Now we're going to speed up at the end, like a horse getting towards the home. So I'm sorry for these questions that have come at the end. As the severity of our society's cultural disorientation dawns on me, I am somewhat overwhelmed with feelings of agitation, frustration, and even despair. In what ways might I foster or practice equanimity without falling into the trap of indifference in the face of this urgent, if not desperate, situation? So, feeling, being in touch with events, and trying to find ways to practice equanimity without practicing indifference. So I have the feeling these last three questions are actually very similar. So I'm going to read all of them. Loving kindness is the title of the question. Loving kindness, ? Underlined. If someone is, i.e. family or friend, talking and being very negative, aggressive, or generally toxic to themselves or those near them, okay? So if someone in your life is being negative, aggressive, or toxic, is it best to keep out of their business? Or is it best to say to them, you are being very toxic and I don't want to be part of that, and leave? Or if they stop, then stay. What is loving kindness here? Okay, could you follow the question? So it's three huge and very good questions, but let's see how it goes. Or maybe I'll save this one aside. Okay. So we have probably, at least, it's easy to think that right now the situation on the planet is at a kind of crisis and breaking point that may have happened before and we forgot as a species or whatever. Or may not have happened ever before. It's easy to see it like that. It's easy to see that it could be that it's never been in human time such a crisis that it looks like, it feels like maybe there is something we could do about it. So it's not just like a meteor is coming or something like that. And there are a lot of, I think, like what I see is like layers in us that keep us from being free in our response, in our participation in what's happening. So if as the person says, it's so easy to feel overwhelmed. Like we can't quite believe can't quite believe what's happening in so many areas. We can't quite believe right now that is happening. Whether it's forests or people, whether it's wars, and things that are not called wars but are wars, etc. I think that our own kind of inner so-called work can really inform this inner work to include the outer, if that makes sense. In the same way that we would find what is toxic and what is urgent inside. And we would first have to notice that I'm ignoring it. I don't want to deal with it. I want someone else to take it away. I want to find a magic answer that won't be painful. I want it to be just a way of perceiving, oh, I just have to see it in another way. It's not really that bad. Or anyway, if I hurry, maybe I'll get enlightened before I self-destruct or something like that. A kind of edge between insanity and crazy wisdom that we would maybe like to find in our despair. And part of the work of deep ecology, I mentioned John Seed before and Joanna Macy also, what they found is that mostly, we so easily just go into a state of shock, or we could also use the word of this question, the trap of indifference. Sometimes when we hear the word, oh, someone's being indifferent, it's easy to construct that as like the person is purposely ignoring, like purposely, like this is not important, purposely crushing down a response. And our actual experience is that it, out of our control, we're locked in our not response. Partly because it's such a powerful response that would come through us in answer to what we experience, whether it's inside or outside. And to remember that our kindness gets activated with our courage our joy. It's almost like I want to say that the joy and the courage are one thing. I would like to say that they're one thing. So our indifference, when we're practicing indifference, it's our not allowing the joy, courage, joy, to move through what we thought we were. And so it's easy, when it feels like a crisis emergency, to tense up and think more, and try too hard, to go back to the nervous system thing. But it also could be that this very same situation does something else. So it just comes to mind again, our friend Bonnie Bainbridge-Cohen, talking about this, the nervous system when we're trying to be aware, and then another way. She says, if we would then try to be aware as we're moving about the room, we're much more likely to bump into each other, fall down, scrape against the wall, bang on the door, and also not have fun, than if we would be like we are in a small space, moving quickly. So if we would try to move slowly, be careful, we're going to bump into each other more. In her experience, that's what happens. And if we just say, all right, move, there's not enough space for us. And don't try too hard, just move. We tune into another place that's not the jangled nervous system. And something happens that would be like when the birds are moving or the fish are moving together. the question about the loving kindness, Papaji used to say that when we would say the word pollution, we are polluting. And so as important as it is to open our eyes, to see aggression that we haven't seen, to see what it is, to see it as it is, if we fall into the trap of indifference, we'll start to call the person a toxic person. We'll start to see pollution as only pollution. We won't stay with our really free response. So if there's not a right thing to do, it's going to be easier to see our games in the sense of not letting life play through me, but me trying to play with life, trying to control. And so if my response to a person's aggressive behavior is that I want to just control them so that they don't hurt me, or control them so that they don't hurt someone else, if I'm trusting control, it's again like going back up to that curious about, knowing about. And if I could stay with knowing as, yes, we have aggression. But it doesn't put anyone out of the game. How can I find a wider game that can play that much? Without saying I have to go and do an intervention, like where the whole family and all the friends like from the whole life come and kind of trap the person and say, like, you have to go to the rehabilitation center, which could be a way to do it sometimes. But not that that's what we're trying to trick ourselves into doing. We're really trusting love and not control, which is nearly unbearable. So a few examples just from a Buddha story. There was a monk who was being nasty. And some monks went, I think, to the Buddha or one of his senior students who also taught and asked what to do. And the answer was, if it wouldn't be too much trouble to go and talk, and you think the person would be receptive and able to hear you, go and talk to the person. If it would be a lot of trouble, but the person would be receptive to hear you, go and talk to the person. Even if it would be a lot of trouble for you, it will save a lot of trouble for that person and other people. Knowing that it may take a lot of time. If it would be not much trouble to you and the person wouldn't necessarily hear you, you could try. Why not? If it would be a lot of trouble to you and they will not hear you, then it's a really nice line of the Buddha. He sometimes comes with these lines that just... Equanimity towards such a person cannot be underrated. I would love to know as the Buddha, like, was he smiling when he said that? Does he know how funny he is? All right, so if I may have permission to use 5 minutes for the last question, because it is a huge question that I'm not qualified to answer, but I really want to bring it into here. Maybe that's why it comes last, so we can all feel it. And it's similar, related, has some relation to the previous two questions. What are we supposed to do with our story of progress, personally and culturally, especially when culturally we need it, we need the story of progress, as in the case of oppressed cultures? And the second part is, how can the Dharma reach these cultures that have been... used as components of other people's games. So, I want to make a little bit more concrete for a moment. So I grew up in the southeastern United States, as you might know. The city where I grew up was the headquarters for a lot of the civil rights groups who were people of many different backgrounds and colors, literally risking their lives to change the icebergs of the way of thinking in the culture. So it's hard to believe, this is one of these things, it's hard to believe that in my part of the world, when my parents were alive, and some of it happened when I was also alive, like in my lifetime, if there would be a black person and a white person just driving in a car, just driving in a car, they knew they had a good percentage chance of being killed, especially at that time. And some of them were killed just for driving in a car together. They didn't have the tinted windows back then, so. If, as they would drive along, maybe going towards a church meeting, or maybe going towards a nonviolent action of just sitting together in a cafeteria, in a cafe, ready for anything, ready to be killed, beaten. They would have to drive so carefully. If they forgot to turn the blinker on enough seconds before the stoplight, they would be arrested because there was a police car driving behind them, just waiting for the smallest excuse. Because then once arrested, once off the street, can we like know what happens when they got off the street and went into the jail? Can we know it? And what does this that we're doing here and Dharma et al., what does it have to do together? So we could feel, how can it not go together? I hope we feel, how can it not go together? So in the same country, so this failing country, United States, I found it so strange. I can understand, but I found it so strange when it was assumed, when Obama was elected president, it was assumed that this was a victory for the black community. And I'm not trying to say that the white people should claim the victory again, but how is it not us together, something to be so proud about? And how to say that without in any way taking away what that is for black people. So that's an example of a cultural story of progress that we need. So how can we leave it sacred for African Americans and also have it be sacred wider than that? So I'm just going to end with a kind of small image that comes to mind that's not in any way an adequate response to this question. But
can I just interject? How do we abandon that?
How do we abandon that?
Yeah.
Do you mean...
the story.
But do you mean in a negative or a positive way?
It doesn't matter, actually. It doesn't matter. Okay. I mean, for any reason, actually. You could abandon it for a negative way. You could abandon it for a positive way.
Okay, so I hope that this silly way that is coming to me to might give away with this. I think if we... so a small... just to begin, okay. That is possible within one lifetime. In the outer world, like in a culture which is much more slow-moving than in a person, can... like, inspire us every day when we think it is unbearable. So many parts that people risk their lives, that people are risking their lives. And that there was that much change so fast in a culture. And I'm not saying that we're finished. Again, like another starting point now. Also in our practice, if we can keep finding how we keep coming to starting points, we keep coming to another starting point. That's when it's a breakthrough, we've come to a new starting point. If we can feel that inspired, like the company of those, the company of that much skillfulness and heart and going beyond what we thought we were. Then we don't actually need to abandon it, but we can use that same story as the starting point. So here's my silly image that comes to my mind. Occasionally, sometimes in my life, it's happened that I was traveling alone instead of with someone or with people. And I found that when I was traveling alone, I was much more open to kind of cross lines. So standing in line in Delhi in the immigration line, and there was someone in front of me, a man, and I felt I have to speak to him. And I thought, oh God, he's gonna think I'm coming on to him. Here I am alone, it's the middle of the night, what, how boring. But it kept coming, I have to say, I have to say, I have to say, I have to say. So finally, hello. Where are you from? Okay, and it turned out he was coming on an urgent last-minute trip to find someone to help him with a film about transgender people in India. And I said, I know your person, which is a friend of mine who is an Indian female photographer who photographs Indian transgender people. And I said, here's her phone number. I shouldn't give you her phone number, but here's her phone number. Which the phone number had changed. Her father had just died. She was like, I don't want to see you. Call me next year. She's like, I've got to do this. I have 3 weeks. I've got to do it now. And he somehow found the number. They had changed the code, and so he had the number, but not quite. He got connected to her. She is in the movie. It's a beautiful movie. That's one example. Okay. If I had been traveling with Gemma and Gyan, I don't think I would have necessarily done it. Which would be fine. Like, he would have come and dropped the film. And she would have stayed in the grief of her father, and it's okay. So if we could feel that much free response as we would if we feel ourselves also alone, like, this is also a personal story and a cultural story, like, we're traveling as a group, all of them are with us, and I'm alone. I'm alone in the way that I'm free to go across the lines. Okay. That's what I have to say so far about that. So thank you for listening and being here.